Selected Shorts is sponsored by ZabarsCoffee.com, featuring hand-selected and custom-roasted Zabar's coffee, shipped daily to coffee drinkers across America who want a great cup of coffee at a reasonable price. Available at ZabarsCoffee.com. ZabarsCoffee.com.
From PRI, Public Radio International.
Not in search of an Owen Wilson type, not ISO, anyone who looks, acts, sounds like, or does an impression of Owen Wilson, in search of the actual Owen Wilson. Feels that the problem with these ads is that there's a valley between how people portray themselves and how they actually are, between what they are looking for and what actually responds. Has one brief but compellingly unfortunate prior experience with personal ads in which one respondent who described himself as a handsome and well-dressed 40-year-old in fact could only be compared to Deputy Dog.
You're listening to Jill Eikenberry reading from Elizabeth Crane's story, Ad, one of the two tales about women in today's edition of Selected Shorts, a celebration of the short story. This series originates in live performance on stage at Symphony Space on Broadway 95th Street in New York City. I'm Isaiah Sheffer. We have two stories for you about women in the news, or at least women in print. The first of these has one of the shortest titles in the history of our series, just two letters long, Ad. That's A-D, Ad. And it was written by Elizabeth Crane, who has published three collections of short fiction. Have you ever wondered exactly what you would say if you were driven to place a personal ad describing yourself and what you were seeking? Here's the fantasy of one SWF, Elizabeth Crane, read for us by the fine actress who won 5 Emmy nominations for her work on the TV series L.A. Law, Jill Eikenberry.
SWF. Above average, on a really good day. On a bad day, still fairly cute. But you might want to mention that her hair doesn't look too big before she has to ask. Frequently compared to a certain movie star, who shall remain nameless. A, in case you don't think she resembles the star. B, in case you don't find the star especially beautiful. And also C, because every time someone says they look like someone in a personal ad, it's more like those separated at birth things where the allegedly more attractive person suddenly looks distorted and creepy, like Winona Ryder looks eerily like Vincent Price. And you can never really see her again in the same way. Or if it's a guy who's comparing himself to, let's say, Ed Harris, when in fact he looks more like Curly. Is not even remotely overweight, but has finally and recently and very reluctantly joined a gym, due only to her doctor mentioning something about crumbling bones. Stares with open-jawed fascination when the guy at the front desk says, "Enjoy your workout." Thinks better of her inclination to start a long conversation with the front desk guy about how that's really possible. Feels as though no one wants to just come out and say working out is just not fun, excluding the random stand-up comic who will make ironic use of the word work. And so she will be the one to say that it is not only not fun, but that sometimes it actually hurts. And that if there's some point at which one progresses past the hurt, she hasn't reached it. Although she does love to walk and would consider playing volleyball if a rare group of non-competitive volleyball players inclined toward reassuring commentary after any errors or mishaps, invited her to play. Enjoys tossing a frisbee, which she's only ever done about twice but would like to do again. Believes the frisbee crowd is a much more tolerant type of crowd, albeit a generally sandal-wearing block. Sandal-wearing being a singly character-revealing quality, far and away less tolerable than something as potentially life-removing and unpleasant to be around as, let's say, smoking, which more people seem to be inclined to consider giving up. Insofar as the desire to display one's feet publicly is always either present or not, And on the subject, it seems like Chicago as a city is much more tolerant of and replete with sandal wearers, unlike New York, where a healthy shame for such things is more widely practiced. Plus, yuck, just the idea of walking around any major city with your feet exposed to the world seems like an incomprehensible risk, which she realizes doesn't up her odds of meeting the perfect non-sandal-wearing man. Nevertheless, this is probably the only thing she'd ever actively attempt to change about a person. And she can make a really good and lengthy case, and if you really love her, you'll just give in to this one thing. Loves to ride a bike in places without streets, e.g. Fire Island, which for most people is only a summer community, but which she believes ought to serve as a model for cities nationwide. Listens to NPR, but doesn't suggest you quiz her on Dostoevsky or anything. Comes from a musical academic family, has been writing since shortly after her long-term memory begins, but has only recently profited from this endeavor due to a current lull in her 25-year run of self-loathing. Raised in Manhattan, relocated to Chicago in favor of affordable housing with functioning / sunlight-bearing windows. Work history including but not limited to opera singing, Wendy's, network news, soap opera extra, waitressing, talent management, private tutor, personal assistant / launderer to star of a low-rated situation comedy, rubber stamp sales, preschool teaching, depressing and mind-screwingly prolonged periods of unemployment, scattered in there, leading, as you might imagine, to even longer periods of unemployment, and numerous on-set coffee-fetching type jobs ultimately leading to filmmaking. Trained in several areas, including typing, bartending, and stand-up comedy, dropping out after being informed that she was not funny. Holds a bachelor's degree in radio and TV, you heard that right, on the 4.5-year plan due to indecision / alcohol abuse. Enjoys curtain sewing, quilting, flower growing, card making, knitting, journal writing, but refuses under any circumstances to succumb to the now popular usage of journal as a verb. Might mention that there are any number of etymological changes that she's seen in her lifetime that she finds exasperating that often involve changing nouns into verbs. Still loves movies, but can only name a sorry few in recent years that have been at all life-changing or even afternoon-changing. Which is maybe unreasonable. Maybe she should try harder to believe she could ever meet an adorable tycoon in a chat room, or that she might pick up someone remotely Richard Gere looking if she endeavored into prostitution. But then again finds the lack of life-changing movies to be weirdly inspiring insofar as it has created a drive to make her own life or afternoon-changing movies for other people. Plus also has the sense that in Chicago, if you go to a movie alone and happen to run into someone, the response is likely to be a well-meaning but loneliness-implying, "I'd have gone with you," as opposed to the implicit understanding of New Yorkers for the need to be separate from the presence of others, given that others are so frequently and intrusively present, leading to a solemn nod at most. Unashamedly loves a broad range of chick singers. Okay, some shame. Excluding only country and or any sort of post-Aretha Franklin melisma. Believes in God, but would have to double the length of this ad to explain what it is she does and doesn't believe, encompassing all God-related doubts, questions, and fears. After extensive research, determined that it is better for everyone involved if she doesn't drink, coming to this conclusion after one of the more prolonged periods of unemployment in which beer and sofa became her primary fields of interest. Coupled with a tendency to find boyfriends who seemed considerably more appealing under the influence of large quantities of beer, unable to give up beer by sheer force of will, joined a 12-step program that not only helped her with the beer-slash-sofa issue, subtracting beer-slash-sofa from the equation actually helped her in bunches of ways, such as she can actually go to a party now and not be completely terrified of saying something unbelievably stupid, or being able to find meaningful work, or generally getting along in the world more comfortably without being in some state of unconsciousness. Although the etymology thing resurfaces again here, because there is a tendency in 12-step programs to create words and phrases that don't exist outside of 12-step programs, e.g., uncomfortability, or family of origin, or rage as a verb, or phrases like my last drunk, meaning not the last drunk person they dated or possibly owned, but to mean the last time they drank, and maybe those two extra words are a time consideration, which wouldn't explain the extra four syllables in uncomfortability when one could simply use the less wieldy discomfort. Except when considering that alcoholics seem to like having a word that indicates a greater discomfort than non-alcoholic discomfort. Has some lingering driving issues, e.g., does not enjoy passengers. / left turns. / the expressway. / snow, / rain, / dew. But drives anyway, since the closest L stop is a mile away and the buses are intolerably slow. Plus, the space invasions are too numerous to even list. There's a lot of food on the bus, e.g., buttered corn on a stick is popular, which really you just don't want to get too close to. Defects of character include, but are not necessarily limited to, excessive fascination with self, not to be confused with selfishness or vanity. Vanity. A tendency to shout when things don't go her way, more often than not in the privacy of her own home. E.g., printers jamming repeatedly, or not being able to reach an actual operator after punching numbers into ComEd's automated voice system repeatedly, or pretty much anything that happens repeatedly. Unsuccessful repetition of any kind has resulted in shouting, occasionally regarded by others as delusional, at least with regard to who she thinks will date her, whether they're 25 or possibly a movie star. Has an obsession with buying 3 books for every 1 read, a tendency to believe that large numbers of candles, / office supplies, / antique clocks, / valentines, / photos, / toys will result in some sort of self-improvement, and a serious television addiction. More accurately, the television is usually on if she is in any way awake, whether or not it's being paid attention to. However, there is generally and simultaneously a laptop in her lap, any one of the 6 books / magazines / journals she's usually reading at one time in her lap, an art / textile / bead / yarn related project in her lap, dinner or a snack food somewhere near her lap. Not nearly often enough is there anything warm and lifelike in or near her lap. Could easily be persuaded to turn off the television in order to fully participate if pleasurable lap-oriented activity seemed imminent. In search of Owen Wilson for a long-term relationship, possibly involving children and a simple but elegant ceremony in which she gets to wear some beautiful whitish, possibly vintage dress with a gardenia in her hair or some other little fragrant blossoms, and on which occasion she would certainly not subject her very best girlfriends to wearing something hideous in any misguided attempt to offset her own glory. In which there are maybe some little kids in velvet tossing rose petals down the aisle, in which they have a bonfire and a weenie roast on the beach and a cake made of marshmallows, in which everyone goes swimming in their fancy clothes, in which friends come from far and also from wide to celebrate their unprecedented great love, in which toasts are made in memory of her mom, in which she will probably mess up her makeup, walking down the aisle wishing her mom was there, in which her stepdad will say that she is there, which she will understand but will prefer his meaning to be literal, that he would then say, "No, really, she's right there," and there she would be on the bride's side of the aisle in a tasteful and timeless silk suit. She was always willing to spend money on any timeless garment as an investment. And expensive shoes, a concession to her daughter, imploring her to treat herself to one really nice pair of neutral shoes instead of 40 pairs of identical shoes in every color from Payless. Wiping her eyes with a typically wrinkly embroidered hanky from the bottom of her purse, but also whispering to her stepfather something like, "Finally," and making a face about somebody's tacky and not at all timeless outfit, is figuring that if her mom doesn't show up from the afterlife to attend her simple but elegant wedding, she can't imagine when she would come. Unless she has kids right away, maybe then she would come. Not in search of an Owen Wilson type, not ISO, anyone who looks, acts, sounds like, or does an impression of Owen Wilson, in search of the actual Owen Wilson. Feels that the problem with these ads is that there's a valley between how people portray themselves and how they actually are, between what they are looking for and what actually responds. Has one brief but compellingly unfortunate prior experience with personal ads in which one respondent who described himself as a handsome and well-dressed 40-year-old in fact could only be compared to Deputy Dog. If D-Dog had a comb over and wore a soiled t-shirt with pleated pants and was closer to 60 and not a cartoon. That it seems like maybe people are not only not being truthful enough, they're not being specific enough. And so has decided to try and set a precedent with regard to specificity. Of course, that said, she's unable to specify what OW should be like, since he's already like whatever he's like, and realizes that the phrase "seeks Owen Wilson" is an unusual phrase to stumble across while reading the personal ads. Except imagine you're Owen Wilson and you're reading the personal ads, which is admittedly unlikely to begin with, but imagine that someone who knows you, Owen Wilson, reads the personal ads and bothers to read this kind of long one and then passes it on to you, and maybe it's a little weird. Still, you read past the first few pages and get to the part where it says, "seeks Owen Wilson," and not even "seeks Owen Wilson type." Imagine that, because it seems possible that you might be flattered. Maybe you'd even feel luckier than usual that you were Owen Wilson, in the same way that some larger group of guys might feel lucky that they were 25 to 45 attractive and successful. Especially if there were any possibility that there were other days when you might feel that there were drawbacks to being Owen Wilson, such as even having to incorporate the word paparazzi into your vocabulary and trying to say it with any kind of seriousness, or having to fire your former personal assistant for napping in your bed in your PJs while you were out, which was a particular bummer because you really thought of him as a bud. Or like if your brother got picked to be People's Sexiest Man Alive, but you didn't. Or worse, like if they were considering having sexiest brothers alive, but then for some reason decided that your brother Luke by himself was the better choice. Or constantly wondering if people were only interested in you because you were Owen Wilson, which it should be made clear is not what's happening here, because if you were Owen Wilson but you were any kind of a tool, she would be as uninterested in getting involved as she would be with any other less famous tool. The hope is that OW will exhibit an inviting and exhilarating humanity, but also maybe it would be good if they were sort of equal, that maybe Owen Wilson also has some tolerable habits or defects of character. Almost any manner of insecurity is acceptable. and almost welcome, as it tends to make her feel more normal to hang around people who also, let's say, have occasional afternoon-ruining relapses into self-doubt. Or if it turns out that he spends a little too much in the way of both time and products trying to get his hair to look like that, that would be all right. But maybe it should also be said that it's totally unacceptable if the insecurities make the other person feel inferior in any way. See the whole tool thing. While she absolutely believes in the possibility that some non-actual Owen Wilson could amuse and entertain and hopefully arouse her interest just as much as the actual Owen Wilson, she hasn't met such a person thus far, or she wouldn't be placing an ad, especially one that potentially portrays her as a stalker of any kind, which she is not. She would totally walk away from anyone, Owen Wilson or not O.W., who wasn't moved by her possibly certain movie star looks and slightly above average, if cluttered, mind. That is to say, she's as familiar with rejection as anyone and is generally not inclined to try to reverse any rejection-oriented decision, as she understands that to be futile, having on occasion been in the position of rejecting and grateful not to have any stalking situations inflicted on her. In other words, she's willing to suffer the rejection, but not willing to sit around anymore waiting for any Owen Wilsons, real or otherwise, to come knocking on her door just out of the blue or something. Realizes that a story in the form of a personal ad potentially invites a variety of criticism, e.g., thinly veiled autobiography of previous work reaches unprecedented levels of self-consciousness, that sort of thing. Also realizes that just because she realizes it doesn't mean it still won't happen. Autobiography is veiled at least insofar as the author of this personal ad is actually spoken for and therefore does not wish to mislead Owen Wilson into thinking she is available, while also not meaning to diminish his appeal in any way. Supposes that her boyfriend who admits to a crush on Drew Barrymore wouldn't freak out if she admitted to finding Owen Wilson appealing, given the likelihood of either of them meeting and subsequently dating Drew Barrymore or Owen Wilson via the personal ads. Although writing this, her mind is already going to the bad place wherein Owen Wilson reads the personal ad and shows it to Drew Barrymore, who somehow finds out who the author's boyfriend is and where he lives and then flies on her private jet to Chicago and they meet and she jets the author's boyfriend away and they have lobster and truffles in their waterbed on the private jet and laugh about leaving the SWF behind. And Owen Wilson is already in a serious relationship and not even with Selma Hayek or whoever, but with like some other overhyped author she thinks is particularly bad. Anyway, after that little digression, the wrap-up becomes a bit problematic in that you know now that this has a happy non-Owen Wilson ending, but that seems fitting under the circumstances.
Elizabeth Crane's charming story, Ad, was read by Jill Eikenberry. We'll be back after a break with a story by Eudora Welty in which a woman reads about herself in the local newspaper. You're listening to Selected Shorts, recorded live in performance at Symphony Space in New York City and at other venues nationwide from PRI, Public Radio International. Welcome back to Selected Shorts. Selected Shorts is sponsored by ZabarsCoffee.com, featuring hand-selected and custom-roasted Zabar's coffee, shipped daily to coffee drinkers across America who want a great cup of coffee at a reasonable price. Available at ZabarsCoffee.com. sabarscoffee.com. The novelist Ann Patchett was the guest host for our evening at Symphony Space celebrating Welty.
Hello. I'm always so happy to be here, and I'm thrilled to be back. And I'm always thrilled to be promoting the short story, and especially the short stories of Eudora Welty, which are near and dear to my heart. I'm going to read you a little paragraph. This is from Suzanne Marr's book, Eudora Welty, A Biography. And this says, Ford Madox Ford followed Catherine Ann Porter's suggestion that he read stories by Eudora, and he did indeed like them. On January 7th, 1939, he wrote to tell Eudora that he would be delighted to recommend a book of her stories to publishers. And on January 19th, he asked her to send a copy of her stories to Stanley Unwin in London. For his part, Ford promised to try to place the stories with a New York publishing house. Neither of these efforts on Eudora's behalf would be successful. No one wanted short stories. Everyone wanted a novel. Eudora continued to write short stories, nevertheless. Yeah, that's right. 1939, they still wanted the novel. I don't know how many of you out there are writing and how many of you heard this. The short story is the best, most beautiful, and most beleaguered art form, although I guess poetry could probably give it a good, healthy run for its money. I had a young friend just last week who was trying to sell her first collection of short stories, and everybody came back and said, yes, we'll take them as long as you have a novel, too. And I'm happy to say that Lydia held out just as a short story writer, and even though Eudora wrote wonderful novels later on, she, in fact, was able to publish her collection of short stories. It seems impossible and amazing to think that there was a time that there was a publishing house out there that thought it might not be the best financial move to publish a volume of Eudora Welty's stories, which have been in print ever since and read and loved all over the world. I always like to say that I went to my first short story reading in my life when I was 16 years old. I live in Nashville, so I went to Vanderbilt. And I heard Eudora Welty read. She was 72 at the time. And I went with my hardback collected Eudora Welty short stories, which my mother had given me for my birthday, and I sat in the front row. And it was like going to see the Beatles. And it was the biggest moment of my life. And since I'd never been, I didn't know you waited until the end. She was sitting up on stage. And I decided to make my move, and before she started to read, I ran up on stage with my book, and I opened it to the first page, and she said, no, dear, this page, and she turned. And I mean, it doesn't sound like much, but honestly, it was like touching the hem of Tolstoy's gown or something. And it changed my life. That's what I wanted to be. I knew it. I wanted to be her, and I never was, but she certainly set me on the right path.
The novelist Ann Patchett. This is Selected Shorts, and we're listening to stories about women in the news. Eudora Welty's masterful stories about Southern women always have surprising premises. In the one we hear now, entitled A Piece of News, a woman spreading newspapers on the floor spots an astonishing article about herself. Welty's biographer, Suzanne Marrs, was on hand at Symphony Space the evening we presented this story. Here she is commenting on Welty's life and work. She's introduced by the novelist Ann Patchett.
This is actually a little out of order that I would come back to introduce Suzanne Marrs, but I asked if I could. Suzanne is a professor of English and the Welty Foundation Scholar in Residence in Millsap College in Jackson, Mississippi. Which is a big deal for me because I'm married a Mississippi boy, so I'm down there all the time. And she will be directing the National Endowment for the Humanities, Landmarks of American History and Culture, which will be based at the Eudora Welty House and will offer, get this, 100 high school English teachers from all over the country get to come to Jackson, Mississippi for the summer, which if you've never been to Jackson, Mississippi in the summer, let me tell you, that's a bit of a challenge in itself, to study Welty's works in her house. Imagine coming from Los Angeles and Maine and Florida to Jackson, Mississippi to read Eudora Welty. I can't think of anything that would be hotter or better. Suzanne became a fan of Eudora Welty's in 1975 when she first read Losing Battles, and she became a friend of Eudora Welty's in 1983 when she first drove down to Jackson without a confirmed appointment, hoping to interview her. They hit it off in a big way, and Suzanne wound up moving to Jackson, and in 1998 asked if she could be her biographer, and I have this picture in my mind where you lean over the table and you say, "Could I maybe be your biographer?" And it's a wonderful thing. I have this theory that writers write because they long to be understood. And as a writer, I can say that's really very funny because there's nothing that makes you feel as misunderstood as writing. And I think that in Suzanne Mars, Eudora Welty had a reader and a friend who understood the complexity of her work and was able to dismiss the stereotypes that surrounded her as a person and shine a light on what she was, which is one of the greatest writers of the 20th century, Suzanne Mars.
Return with me now to those thrilling days of yesteryear. I would love to be a radio announcer, and I couldn't resist starting with that line. But I really want to ask you just to return with me to 1937. In 1937, radio listeners might have been hearing the strains of Boo Hoo from Guy Lombardo's band, or They Can't Take That Away From Me from Fred Astaire, or Sing, Sing, Sing with memorable solos by Benny Goodman, Harry James, and Gene Krupa. From the news department, they might have heard an on-site eyewitness report of the horrifying crash of the German Zeppelin Hindenburg, or an excited description of the opening of the San Francisco Bay Bridge, or a more distant analysis of President Roosevelt's attempt to enlarge the Supreme Court. They surely relished learning of the marriage of Wallace Simpson and the former King Edward VIII of England, mourned the disappearance of Amelia Earhart, and followed accounts of the Spanish Civil War. Families gathered round the radio for comedies like Fibber McGee and Molly, mysteries like The Shadow featuring Orson Welles, or westerns like The Lone Ranger. None of these 1937 radio listeners, however, had the pleasure of hearing the Eudora Welty stories you have heard tonight, or the one you will hear when I finish my remarks. In 1937, Eudora Welty was a high-spirited young woman of 28 who was almost unknown as a writer. She was living in her native Jackson, Mississippi, writing, at least for the moment, obscure stories and entertaining herself in a variety of ways. She acted in a local production of Gold in the Hills. Her performance as a housekeeper was a comic triumph, according to the local paper. She and two friends wrote parodies of notable poems and gathered them in a book that they titled Lilies That Fester. That title is drawn from a line in Shakespeare's 94th sonnet, "Lilies that fester smell far worse than weeds." Eudora did travel to New York City for the opening of her second one-woman photographic show and presumably saw her favorite comedian, Bee Lilly, in a hit review titled The Show Is On. Presumably, she also avoided the dangers her Columbia University dorm director had warned against some years earlier. Eliza Reese Butler offered this caution to Welty and other Mississippians at Columbia's Johnson Hall: "Never accept an aspirin from a stranger." Or the next thing you know, you'll wake up in Buenos Aires in a house of prostitution with a friend of your father staring down at you. Well, that prospect never became a reality. But later in 1937, Eudora undertook what her mother thought was a dangerous enterprise. She traveled by car to Mexico along with her friends John, Will, and Annabelle Robinson. Safely back home, she landed one small assignment as a photographer for Life magazine, but her fiction did not claim national attention. It appeared in out-of-the-way magazines or not at all. When Robert Penn Warren at the Southern Review rejected Petrified Man, a story many of you have seen in high school textbooks, I think, when Robert Penn Warren rejected Petrified Man, Welty burned her only copy in the kitchen wood stove. She would later rewrite the story from memory when Warren reconsidered his decision. In fact, she felt so guilty about doing that that she spoke to Robert Penn when she finally met Robert Penn Warren. She said, I've got to tell you that I burned that story and I rewrote it from memory. I hope you don't think that was dishonest. And Warren said, you wrote it, didn't you? Well, the three stories we are hearing tonight all had their origins in 1937. One, like Petrified Man, was rejected, but two were published that year. Lily Daw and the Three Ladies found its way into print at Prairie Schooner. A piece of news was accepted by the Southern Review, but the key would not make its debut until 1941. The spark for a piece of news actually predates 1937 by 9 years. During the Christmas vacation of her junior year at the University of Wisconsin, Welty visited the Lewistown, Montana home of a college friend. This girl's father edited the local newspaper and was happy to hire Welty as a reporter for the duration of her visit. While Welty was at the newspaper office one freezing day, a country woman snowshoed into town to demand a retraction. The report that her husband had shot her, she declared, was absolutely false. The humor of the situation struck the almost 19-year-old Eudora Welty, but the incident also elicited a more serious and enduring reaction. Welty would use this event as the basis for a piece of news. The power of the written word to evoke an emotional response, this more than the humor of the occurrence, stayed with Welty and became the heart of her story. Drawing on such distant memories was a process that eventually would become very important to Welty's writing, but it is quite unusual in her early work, and it's not surprising that Welty chose to set the story in a locale more congenial to her imagination, a locale much like one she had recently visited when traveling through North Mississippi for the Works Progress Administration. As she describes two isolated, poor, barely literate individuals like those she had so often encountered on her WPA travels, Welty implicitly suggests the important role a story, be it a factual narrative or a piece of fiction, can play in the lives of those attuned to it. The newspaper article in a piece of news, though it is misunderstood or misinterpreted, prompts the story's characters to interact, to feel a double shame and a double pleasure, to use Welty's words. Her two characters jointly imagine a melodrama that might have been. That shared act of imagination brings the stories Clyde and Ruby very close, closer than sharing the same food, the same bed, the same cabin, and we sense the momentary existence of a third character, of a stranger who is the incarnation of a relationship between the two. So Ann Patchett sees this story as a story about writing, and I see it as a story about reading, the writer, the reader, but we both see it as a story about stories and the power of stories. So, in 1937, Eudora Welty, still 2 years shy of 30, was producing great stories, but was toiling in relative obscurity. Only a novel, it was believed, would allow her to command national attention. Robert Penn Warren in 1938 suggested that Welty turn her hand to a novel and enter that work in a fiction competition at Houghton Mifflin. So this lover of the short story wrote and submitted a longer piece, and the Southern Review backed her case. The manuscript she produced centers upon a female artist who has rented a tenant farming house in the rural Mississippi woods. Onto this plot, Welty attempted to graft characters drawn from A Piece of News and Lily Dahl, along with material she would eventually publish in The Key. The book won an A rating in the competition, but as editor Robert N. Linscott told Welty, the final award went to A Girl in Idaho for a novel about the Mormon migration. That was almost that for novel writing by Welty. She would not publish a full-scale novel until 1946. And as she wrote in one writer's beginnings, I left Jackson, Mississippi, to arrive at some future and secret joy, at what was unknown and what was in New York, waiting to be discovered. My joy was connected with writing. That was as much as I knew. Welty would henceforth find her way into the pantheon of American writers. Thank you.
That was Eudora Welty's biographer, Suzanne Mars, speaking from the stage at Symphony Space. Now we'll hear Welty's story, A Piece of News, read by Catherine Markey, who's making her Selected Shorts debut. When she isn't busy with serious acting assignments, Catherine Markey is one of the regular singer-songwriters and a cast member of Symphony Space's political cabaret, The Thalia Follies. Now Catherine reads Eudora Welty's A Piece of News.
She had been out in the rain. She stood in front of the cabin fireplace, her legs wide apart, bending over, shaking her wet yellow head crossly, like a cat reproaching itself for not knowing better. She was talking to herself, only a small, fluttering sound, hard to lay hold of in the sparsity of the room. The pouring down rain. Was that what she was saying over and over, like a song? She stood turning in little quarter turns to dry herself, her head bent forward and the yellow hair hanging out streaming and tangled. She was holding her skirt primly out to draw the warmth in. Then, quite rosy, she walked over to the table and picked up a little bundle. It was a sack of coffee, marked sample in red letters, which she unwrapped from a wet newspaper. But she handled it tenderly. Why, how come he wrapped it in a newspaper? She said, catching her breath, looking from one hand to the other. She must have been lonesome and slow all her life, the way things would take her by surprise. She set the coffee on the table just in the center. Then she dragged the newspaper by one corner in a dreamy walk across the floor, spread it all out, and lay down full length on top of it in front of the fire. Her little song about the rain, her cries of surprise, had been only a preliminary, only playful pouting with which she amused herself when she was alone. She was pleased with herself now. As she sprawled close to the fire, her hair began to slide out of its damp tangles and hung all displayed down her back like a piece of bargain silk. She closed her eyes. Her mouth fell into a deepness, into a look of unconscious cunning. Yet in her very stillness and pleasure, she seemed to be hiding there, all alone. And at moments when the fire stirred and tumbled in the grate, she would tremble and her hand would start out as if in impatience or despair. Presently she stirred and reached under her back for the newspaper. Then she squatted there, touching the printed page as if it were fragile. She did not merely look at it. She watched it, as if it were unpredictable, like a young girl watching a baby. The paper was still wet in places where her body had lain. Crouching tensely and patting the creases away with small, cracked red fingers, she frowned now and then at the blotched drawing of something and big letters that spelled a word underneath. Her lips trembled, as if looking and spelling so slowly had stirred her heart. All at once she laughed. She looked up. Ruby Fisher, she whispered. An expression of utter timidity came over her flat blue eyes and her soft mouth. Then a look of fright. She stared about. What eye in the world did she feel looking in on her? She pulled her dress down tightly and began to spell through a dozen words in the newspaper. The little item said, Mrs. Ruby Fisher had the misfortune to be shot in the leg by her husband this week. As she passed from one word to the next, she only whispered. She left the long word, misfortune, until the last and came back to it, and then she said it all over out loud, like conversation. That's me, she said softly, with deference, very formally. The fire slipped and suddenly roared in the house, already deafening with the rain which beat upon the roof and hung full of lightning and thunder outside. You, Clyde? Screamed Ruby Fisher at last, jumping to her feet. Where are you, Clyde Fisher? She ran straight to the door and pulled it open. A shudder of cold brushed over her in the heat, and she seemed striped with anger and bewilderment. There was a flash of lightning, and she stood waiting as if she half thought that would bring him in, a gun leveled in his hand. She said nothing more, and backing against the door, pushed it closed with her hip. Her anger passed like a remote flare of elation. Neatly avoiding the table where the bag of coffee stood, she began to walk nervously about the room as if a teasing indecision, an untouched mystery, led her by the hand. There was one window, and she paused now and then, waiting, looking out at the rain. When she was still, there was a passivity about her, or a deception of passivity, that was not really passive at all. There was something in her that never stopped moving. At last, she flung herself onto the floor, back across the newspaper, and looked at length into the fire. It might have been a mirror in the cabin, into which she could look deeper and deeper as she pulled her fingers through her hair, trying to see herself and Clyde coming up behind her. Clyde? But of course, her husband, Clyde, was still in the woods. He kept a thick brushwood roof over his whiskey still, and he was mortally afraid of lightning like this and would never go out in it for anything. And then, almost in amazement, she began to comprehend her predicament. It was unlike Clyde to take up a gun and shoot her. She bowed her head toward the heat, onto her rosy arms, and began to talk and talk to herself. She grew voluble. Even if he heard about the coffee man with a Pontiac car, she did not think he would shoot her. When Clyde would make her blue, she would go out onto the road. Some car would slow down, and if it had a Tennessee license, the lucky kind, the chances were that she would spend the afternoon in the shed of the empty gin. Here she rolled her head about on her arms and stretched her legs tiredly behind her like a cat. And if Clyde got word, he would slap her. But the account in the paper was wrong. Clyde had never shot her, even once. There had been a mistake made. A spark flew out and nearly caught the paper on fire. Almost in fright, she beat it out with her fingers. Then she murmured and lay back more firmly upon the pages. There she stretched, growing warmer and warmer, sleepier and sleepier. She began to wonder out loud how it would be if Clyde shot her in the leg. If he were truly angry, might he shoot her through the heart? At once she was imagining herself dying. She would have a nightgown to lie in and a bullet in her heart. Anyone could tell, to see her lying there with that deep expression about her mouth, how strange and terrible that would be. Underneath a brand new nightgown, her heart would be hurting with every beat, many times more than her toughened skin when Clyde slapped at her. Ruby began to cry softly, the way she would be crying from the extremity of pain. Tears would run down in a little stream over the quilt. Clyde would be standing above her, as he once looked, with his wild black hair hanging to his shoulders. He used to be very handsome and strong. He would say, Ruby, I'd done this to you. And she would say only a whisper, "That is the truth, Clyde. You've done this to me." And then she would die. Her life would stop right there. She lay silently for a moment, composing her face into a look which would be beautiful, desirable, and dead. Clyde would have to buy her a dress to bury her in. He would have to dig a deep hole behind the house under the cedar, a grave. He would have to nail her up a pine coffin and lay her inside. Then he would have to carry her to the grave, lay her down, and cover her up. All the time he would be wild, shouting, and all distracted to think he could never touch her one more time. She moved slightly, and her eyes turned toward the window. The white rain splashed down. She could hardly breathe for thinking that this was the way it was to fall on her grave, where Clyde would come and stand, looking down in the tears of some repentance. A whole tree of lightning stood in the sky. She kept looking out the window, suffused with the warmth from the fire and the pity and the beauty and power of her death. The thunder rolled. Then Clyde was standing there, with dark streams flowing over the floor where he had walked. He poked at Ruby with the butt of his gun as if she were asleep. "Let's keep in supper," he growled. She jumped up and darted away from him. Then, quicker than lightning, she put away the paper. The room was dark except for the firelight. From the long shadow of his steamy presence, she spoke to him glibly and lighted the lamp. He stood there with a stunned, yet rather good-humored look of delay and patience in his face and kept on standing there. He stamped his mud-red boots, and his enormous hands seemed weighted with the rain that fell from him and dripped down the barrel of his gun. Presently, he sat down with dignity in the chair at the table, making a little tumult of his rightful wetness and hunger. Small streams began to flow from him everywhere. Ruby was going through the preparations for the meal gently. She stood almost on tiptoe in her bare, warm feet. Once, as she knelt at the safe, getting out the biscuits, she saw Clyde looking at her, and she smiled and bent her head tenderly. There was some way she began to move her arms that was mysteriously sweet and yet abrupt and tentative, a delicate and vulnerable manner, as though her breasts gave her pain. She made many unnecessary trips back and forth across the floor, circling Clyde where he sat in his steamy silence, a knife and fork in his fists. "Well, where you been, anyway?" he grumbled at last, as she set the first dish on the table. "Nowhere special. Don't you talk back to me. You've been hitchhiking again, ain't you?" He almost chuckled. She gave him a quick look straight into his eyes. She had not even heard him. She was filled with happiness. Her hand trembled when she poured the coffee. Some of it splashed on his wrist. At that, he let his hand drop heavily down upon the table and made the plates jump. "Someday I'm going to smack the living devil out of you," he said. Ruby dodged mechanically. She let him eat. Then, when he had crossed his knife and fork over his plate, she brought him the newspaper. Again, she looked at him in delight. It excited her even to touch the paper with her hand, to hear its quiet, secret noise when she carried it, the rustle of surprise. "A newspaper?" Clyde snatched it roughly and with a grabbing disparagement. "Where'd you get that, hussy?" "Look at this here," said Ruby in her small, sing-song voice. She opened the paper while he held it and pointed gravely to the paragraph. Reluctantly, Clyde began to read it. She watched his damp, bald head slowly bend and turn. Then he made a sound in his throat and said, "It's a lie." "That's what's in the newspaper about me," said Ruby, standing up straight. She took his plate and gave him that look of joy. He put his big, crooked finger on the paragraph and poked at it. "Well, I'd just like to see the place I shot you," he cried explosively. He looked up, his face blank and bold. But she drew herself in, still holding the empty plate, faced him, straightened and hard, and they looked at each other. The moment filled full with their helplessness. Slowly they both flushed, as though with a double shame and a double pleasure. It was as though Clyde might really have killed Ruby, and as though Ruby might really have been dead at his hand. Rare and wavering, some possibility stood timidly like a stranger between them and made them hang their heads. Then Clyde walked over in his water-soaked boots and laid the paper on the dying fire. It floated there a moment and then burst into flame. They stood still and watched it burn. The whole room was bright. "Look," said Clyde suddenly. "It's a Tennessee paper. See? Tennessee. That wasn't none of you it wrote about." He laughed to show that he had been right all the time. "It was Ruby Fisher," cried Ruby. "My name is Ruby Fisher," she declared passionately to Clyde. "Oh, it was another Ruby Fisher in Tennessee," cried her husband. "Fool me, huh?" "Where'd you get that paper?" He spanked her good-humoredly across her backside. Ruby folded her still trembling hands into her skirt. She stood stooping by the window until everything, outside and in, was quieted before she went to her supper. It was dark and vague outside. The storm had rolled away to faintness, like a wagon crossing a bridge.
A piece of news by Eudora Welty, read for us by Catherine Markey. If you've enjoyed hearing these stories about women and their loves, you might like to know about our selected short CD collection, For Better and For Worse. You can find out all about it by going to selectedshorts.org. You can find out more about the authors and actors on this program, information about Selected Shorts CDs featuring listeners' best-loved readings, and request a free reading list at our website, selectedshorts.org. Selected Shorts is produced by Catherine Minton and directed by Isaiah Sheffer. The executive director of Symphony Space is Cynthia Elliott. Our radio producer is Sarah Montague, and our production assistant is Miranda Schaefer. The readings are recorded by Miles B. Smith, and our mix engineer is Stu Kennedy. Our theme music is Roger Calloway's Come to the Meadow. Major support for Selected Shorts is provided by Houghton Mifflin, publishers of The Best American Short Stories, edited in 2008 by Salman Rushdie, and by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, and on the web at bn.com. Additional support is provided by the Dungannon Foundation, sponsor of the Ray Award for the Short Story, Budget Travel, the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art, the New York State Council on the Arts, a state agency, the Henry Nias Foundation, and the Lila Acheson Wallace Theater Fund of the New York Community Trust. Selected Shorts is a co-production of Symphony Space and WNYC Radio in New York, and is distributed nationwide by PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for this program comes from this station and Public Radio International stations nationwide and is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.